Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're learning more about what Britain's Home Secretary John Reid is describing as an unprecedented terror threat, and other officials are calling mass murder on an unimaginable scale. Scotland Yard police say they've arrested 21 people in connection to an alleged plot to blow up several airplanes traveling from London's Heathrow Airport to the U.S. President Bush commented today on security in the U.S. while at a stop in Wisconsin.
This country is safer than it was prior to 9/11. We've taken a lot of measures to protect the American people, but obviously we're still not completely safe.
Here is what is known about the alleged foiled plot. U.S. counterterrorism officials say terrorists were targeting United, American, and Continental Airlines. The plot, authorities say, was to simultaneously blow up several passenger jets headed to the U.S. from London's Heathrow Airport. The weapons were to have been explosives smuggled in liquids carried in hand luggage. The Associated Press is reporting that French Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy says the suspects in the British terror plot appear to be of Pakistani origin, and security has been heightened at airports from London to the U.S., resulting in massive delays and cancellations. Well, we'll have a report from London in a moment, but first, Here Now's Fred Tice is at Boston's Logan International Airport, and Fred, Washington has raised its threat alert to its highest level for commercial flights. What does this mean for people traveling?
Well, we know that no liquids, no lotions are being allowed in carry-on luggage. This includes drinks. It includes perfume, it includes shampoo, baby formula is allowed, shoes are being x-rayed, and on flights to and from the British Islands, all laptops are banned.
So the ban for laptops on British flights only also includes, you understand, mobile phones, iPods, anything of that nature?
That's correct.
Here in Massachusetts, Governor Romney has said he's going to send out the National Guard to help at the airport. Are you seeing any evidence of that?
The National Guard has not arrived here yet. It would be the first time since the six-month period right after 9/11 that the National Guard would be deployed here at Logan Airport. They will relieve some of the state troopers who can then be freed up for other tasks after 9/11. The state troopers were basically profiling people, looking for suspicious people in the crowd and then stopping them and interrogating them. Mm-hmm. National Guard, we understand, will assist with the checkpoints.
What have you seen of canceled flights going to Europe?
There are some flights that are canceled. There's an American Airlines flight out of Boston that was canceled this morning. But other flights are running. The British Airways flight, for example, left on time this morning. We're expecting another British Airways flight this afternoon.
We understand that there are delays at airports across the country, long security lines. American Airlines has canceled three London-bound flights from Chicago. You mentioned Boston and New York, but it's because of delays at Heathrow. Delta says there would be no cancellations, just some of the things that we're hearing. And, Fred, I'm just wondering, before we let you go, have you had a chance to talk to travelers? What are people saying?
Well, you know, some people are very frustrated. In particular, I spoke to one woman who brought her son here. Her 14-year-old son was traveling from Boston to Madison, Wisconsin. And she wasn't worried when she got to the airport, but then Northwest officials would not take her unaccompanied minor on the flight. They had to call Minneapolis, where the company is headquartered. It took quite some time before they decided that they actually would accept an unaccompanied minor. So the airlines seem to be quite worried about the extra burdens that, helping passengers who may need some assistance may require. Seem to be worried about the security situation.
Well, it's one of the heaviest traveled weeks in airline travel, and so we could probably expect that the last thing you want to tell us is that you have to be patient when you get to the airport.
Here at Logan, we're 60 to 90 minutes to board a flight. People are being told to get here 2 hours before their flight.
Here now is Fred Tice at Boston's Logan International Airport. Fred, thanks.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, at London's Heathrow Airport earlier today, unsuspecting arriving passengers were told they couldn't bring anything on the plane except for maybe a passport or baby formula, and that forced people to drop to the floor wherever they were and start repacking bags. Earlier today, we reached the rolling luggage store at Heathrow Airport and spoke to a sales clerk, Verinda, who described the scene for us.
The airport's really busy. Flights have been cancelled or delayed. People are being sent back home, and it's just sort of very panicky and busy. Today, no one's allowed to take on anything apart from their passport and their boarding pass. So we had a lot of people coming in and just, you know, looking to buy the cheapest bag or just anything they could get their hands on, just to, you know, throw in their mobile phone and, you know, check that in, or, you know, for a camera or their laptop and things like that. So because they're not allowed to take anything on board, everyone was quite panicked and they were just, you know, looking to get the cheapest thing possible.
Oh, so they had to, things that they planned to carry on, they had to suddenly find baggage for.
That's right, yeah. I think everyone's quite annoyed, but it was quite crazy in the morning. Right now, it's a bit better.
Right. And what about, you know, you say annoyed, but what about a fear factor? And yourself, you know, working there at the airport?
To be honest, I don't think a lot of people know exactly what's going on, because if they've been here since, sort of, you know, 5 in the morning, we don't have access to the news here. We don't really know what's going on. So you just have to rely on what you get told by the police, or, you know, and they're not going to say much apart from it's just a security alert. So people are panicked, but, you know, there's a lot more security, there's a lot more police around, and it's very scary, and I'm finishing work soon and just looking forward to going home, really.
Yeah. That's Verinda from Rolling Luggage at Heathrow Airport, a very busy place right now. Verinda, thank you.
Okay, then. Bye-bye.
So Heathrow, people scrambling to find places to put the things they plan to carry on the plane. Staying in London, we turn to The Economist defense and terrorism correspondent James Astill, who's covering the story. And James, of course, that's probably the least of the problems that could have been if, in fact, this plot is true. Let's start with the basics. How many men in custody? What do we know about the circumstances of their arrests?
21 young-ish males in custody, we know. Most of them are indeed, as you hinted earlier, said to have links to Pakistan. I think we may surmise that, and that means a good few of them are ethnically Pakistani, though they may well, and indeed were probably British natives. Most of these men. They were arrested in the very early hours of this morning after the surveillance operation that was expected to run for quite a few days yet was suddenly called off, and the arrest took place.
Well, and in fact, you tell us more about that, because officials are hinting that some sort of attack might have been imminent, which is why this announcement was made.
They have indeed used the word imminent. That could mean weeks, or it could mean days. It's very hard to get a read on these things. However, we do know that there was some trigger, and indeed, I think sources of mine have said several triggers in more than one country that suggested an attack was planned for sooner than they had previously anticipated.
Of course, some of us here were looking at the date. It's 8:10. Of course, the major attack on 9/11. Any thought that that might have had something to do with it?
My sources said specifically that they didn't think they had no firm evidence to believe that this was planned for September the 11th coming.
What about a report that surfaced briefly on CNN that an arrest in Pakistan helped break this story?
There's been a good deal of cooperation between Pakistani and indeed American with British intelligence agencies. So I know that a certain amount of intelligence has been gathered there, whether from that arrest, as a result of that arrest, or from a series of arrests, is very hard to say. The Pakistanis tend to be even less forthcoming with their intelligence than the British and Americans, which is really saying something.
Well, you talk about possible work between Pakistan and Britain. What about between Britain and the U.S.? It was somewhat disturbing to see a quote from the Transportation Security Administration Chief Kip Hawley saying, "This was a surprise to many of us." How much were U.S. officials involved in this? Do we know?
U.S. Intelligence agencies certainly had a heads up on this, and I know that they have been of some help. I think it's fair to say that a very strong leading role was played by British intelligence agencies, both domestic and foreign, with a good deal of help from agencies in Pakistan, and perhaps less a supporting role. We may surmise that surmise at this point was played by American agencies. However, they were certainly aware of the surveillance operation, which has been going on for many months now.
James Astill, defense and terrorism correspondent for The Economist. We want to ask you about what's alleged to have been the method, carrying liquids onto the plane and then mixing them once on the plane in order to blow it up. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, there's an awful lot of guesswork out there already. We know that the planning involved taking liquids onto the plane. Whether those liquids were already, if you like, in bomb form and they would need detonating, or whether the mixing of different chemicals would create the explosion in flight is still really rather a matter of guesswork.
And though even so, apparently carrying liquids on carry-on bands, bags has been banned here in the U.S. All carry-on bags have been banned in London. James, thanks so much for weighing in with us. James Astill again, The Economist defense and terrorism correspondent from London. James, thank you.
Great pleasure.
Well, for more on that alleged method, we turn now to Jennifer Hardwick, Assistant Director of Threats and Analysis at the Terrorism Research Center in Arlington, Virginia. And Jennifer, we just want to touch in with you because this is new to many, a new idea, a horrible idea, this idea of mixing liquids on a plane. But it's not perhaps new to you.
No. Hi, Robin. It's nice to talk to you.
You too.
No, indeed, it's not a new phenomenon. This was seen actually in the 1994-1995 Bujinka plot in Asia, where there was a bomb that was actually successfully detonated on a plane using the same kind of planning, and it actually killed one individual. They were able to safely land the airplane, though.
This was, we believe, this was alleged to have been done by Ramzi Youssef, who was the first World Trade Center bomber.
Exactly.
So what happens? What are the chemicals? Is it easy to find out how to do this? I mean, of course, we don't want to, you know, tell more people how to do it, but is it easy enough to find out?
Sure. Well, we're suspecting that the liquid that they're speaking about is called nitroglycerin. Nitroglycerin is fairly readily available. That was what was used in the Bujinka plotting, and so folks were able to acquire it in South Asia. It's used often in military technologies for smoke as smokeless powders. It's also used in dynamite, and then it's also readily available on the internet for medical conditions, heart ailments, and for some poison ingestion.
But if you can carry this on, let's say, in a water bottle, then how can you, if you can't carry lighters, for instance, onto airplanes, how can you ignite it?
Well, that's a great question. It's actually a little bit more difficult to ignite than you would think. You require not only the nitroglycerin, but some acids that are a little bit more difficult to get, sulfuric acid, nitric acid. And then when the chemicals are mixed together, they need to be cooled and then kept in a cold, dark location. So it's not as easy as just, you know, pouring some liquids together and having an explosion.
Jennifer Hardwick, Assistant Director of Threats and Analysis at the Terrorism Research Center in Arlington, Virginia. We want to ask you a couple more questions, Jennifer, so we'll ask you to hang on. We'll take a quick break, finding out as much as we can about the alleged foiled terrorist plot disclosed today by British officials. Disturbing news. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Back with just a few more minutes with Jennifer Hardwick, Assistant Director of Threats and Analysis at the Terrorism Research Center in Arlington, Virginia. Because, Jennifer, we've been talking about the alleged explosive that these 21 suspects arrested in London were alleged to have planned to use in several airplanes, mixing liquids aboard a plane in order to then ignite them. And you were saying it's actually quite hard to do. Where might the spark come from to light something like this?
The nitroglycerin actually doesn't require a spark at all. It just requires the mixing of these chemicals together in a very contained environment. It's probably something that could be done in a bathroom. It could be done probably in the secure area of the airport before boarding the plane. Ramzi Youssef in 1994 was trying to use it and hide it in his shoes so he could at least walk onto the plane with it. But it's a pretty combustible material once it is mixed together, and any sort of jolting is enough for it to detonate.
Well, we're going to be talking to a security expert in a few minutes, but in your opinion, if it's been known for a decade that it's possible to do this, why is it that airline passengers have been allowed to carry liquids on planes unchecked?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I certainly travel a lot, and I can't imagine getting on an airplane without my water or coffee or my iPod or my laptop, for that matter. And so to put that kind of restriction on the U.S. traveling public or the British traveling public is just so – would cause so much uproar, and I think we'll be seeing that in the next couple of days, as people aren't allowed to bring anything but baby formula and medicine on board the airplanes. So I suspect that that's the reason they haven't been doing that. And the airlines have been doing fairly badly financially, and so to put these kinds of restrictions on top of it would really turn away the traveling public.
You've been saying it's risk management. It's, you know, you pick the things you can do.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Right. That's exactly right.
Jennifer Hardwick, Assistant Director of Threats and Analysis at the Terrorism Research Center in Arlington, Virginia. Thanks for checking in with us today, Jennifer.
It's my pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
So who are these 21 suspects? Do they have any ties to Al-Qaeda? One terrorism expert says the apparently foiled plot to take down multiple U.S.-bound flights from Britain makes the London subway attacks look like child's play. That sobering assessment came from Andrea Nativi at the Military Center for Strategic Studies in Rome. Well, we turn now to another terrorism expert joining us on the line from Arlington, Virginia, Farhani Ali, terrorism analyst at the RAND Corporation. Farhana, welcome back as always.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff says this plot is suggestive of Al-Qaeda. He can't be sure yet, is what Michael Chertoff says. Do you agree? And if so, what is suggestive?
I absolutely do agree. I think that at this current time, the links between the suspects and Al-Qaeda is tenuous. I mean, unless there's further investigation or authorities tell us more right now, we can't make such direct linkages. But it is suggestive, and by that, if you look at this foiled plot, you can see that it bears the hallmark of the Al-Qaeda organization. By that, I mean that we can draw some preliminary conclusions, such as the use of spectacular attacks. We know that that's a characteristic of Al-Qaeda, whether it was the 9/11, which is in our most recent memory, or the London attacks. I mean, this is something that Al-Qaeda does very best. And by orchestrating or planning for spectacular attacks, what Al-Qaeda is really doing is making sure that they, what I call, they make headlines, or what I call the CNN factor. So by staying in the news, that also garners further support for their cause. The use of simultaneous attacks, as this plot would have done by using the various airlines, is also a significant point. And being able to inflict mass casualties is another point. And finally, as what Jennifer was talking about in terms of the airlines, that's nothing new. We're going back to the Bojinka plot. She's absolutely right, and I would say that the airlines striking or using the airlines, just as the London bombers used, you know, they hit the transport system, is very important because it represents a Western economic power, and so it's the airlines is actually a very symbolic target.
Right. Well, but others have said that Al-Qaeda is not what it was at 9/11, that it now, you know, has so many isolated cells, maybe motivated by Al-Qaeda, which are taking over. But could an isolated cell coordinate something on this scale?
There's a lot of speculation on that point. Whether this was isolated or not, I'm not sure I would use that term. I would say that Al-Qaeda, you're absolutely correct, is no longer the global movement or organization that it once was, and that's, you know, thanks to our Herculean efforts to actually disrupt or to actually weaken Al-Qaeda's operational leadership. So while bin Laden's Zawahiri no longer have the same command and control structure to direct attacks, what you have now are looser networks that are much more organic. But again, I think it remains to be seen what the linkages are. Even though these are organic cells, they're still quite capable. The fact that this plot, from what we understand, that the use of chemicals, which also bears, I mean, all those same characteristics can be seen in this particular plot. So you have then operational managers that are quite capable, and they have the resources within their, the host country in which they're living to orchestrate these attacks.
And by the way, in your opinion, we had a story here in the U.S. recently in which a group of young men mainly were arrested in the Florida area, and it turned out to they turned out to be more of the gang that couldn't shoot straight. Not that they weren't, potentially dangerous. Do you have any sense that this might be true here also, or what indication are you getting from officials?
Well, again, I think, you know, there's still very little that we know except that there were 21 individuals that were caught. I mean, I think what the British government is doing is very wise and calling them, whether one agrees or not, by using the term, the Home Secretary said they were criminals, so that the blame would not fall onto anyone, religious or ethnic community. And I think that's a really important point. So I think the way that they're even conducting the investigations or the way this case is being handled is very wise. I think that still there's so much more that we don't know yet.
In the minute that we have, the French Interior Minister is saying that suspects in the terror plot appear to be of Pakistani origin. Again, we don't know, but he is saying that.
Right.
And British investigators are saying that arrests in Pakistan led to the arrests overnight in Britain. In the few seconds we have, what would that say to you?
Well, the same claims were made about Shehzad Tanveer, which was a London bomber, and, you know, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who was a ringleader, and that they had linkages to Pakistan as well. I think whatever the case is, I mean, that's something that's really, you know, intelligence organizations or agencies are following that much more closely than someone might, you know, and someone on the outside. But, you know, Pakistan does have its own problems with extremists and jihadi organizations in the country that they're fighting. So to rule that out, to rule that possibility out, I mean, one can't be sure. I mean, it's quite possible that the linkages exist.
Farhani Ali, a terrorism analyst at the RAND Corporation. Farhani, we always thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking to many other people about this story, including a security expert here in the U.S. And don't forget, later in the program, we'll take a break from the real news for the fictional scary stories with Dennis Lehane, coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continue our coverage of the alleged London bomb plot today. 21 men are in custody accused of planning to bring down several planes heading to the U.S. from the U.K. British officials say the suspects plan to smuggle liquid explosives onto the aircrafts and blow the planes up midair. Well, for that reason, Heathrow Airport has now banned carry-on bags and liquids, and American airports are now banning any liquids being brought onto planes. Well, how are these things screened? To learn more about that, we turn to Jack Riley, a Homeland Security expert for RAND Corporation. Jack, this is a very timely story for you. This week you provided testimony to a House Homeland Security subcommittee. We've been looking at that testimony. You talked about security at U.S. airports, and you said we are virtually flying blind. So what were your concerns just a couple of days ago?
Well, the issue of how we check for explosives at airports, I think, has been on the horizon as an important issue, and it's one where we're not quite out in front of the curve. We have a number of airports around the country that are using these explosive detection chambers, these chemical sniffers, to screen passengers. We have the swabbing method to by which luggage is wiped with a piece of cloth, and then the cloth is analyzed for traces of explosives. But it's not security practice that is available at every airport, and it's not clear that that we're able to detect all of the potential explosives that are out there.
Well, that's what we were going to ask, because it was our understanding, and we hope you can clarify, that these tests that we have are, you know, seem to be for powders or things that might leave a residue. Does that also apply to liquid explosives?
It would depend a lot on ultimately finding out what explosives they intended to use as part of this plot. At this point, I have no information on what the explosives were. Secretary Chertoff, in his press conference this morning, made mention that the expectation was that they were actually going to mix them, combine liquids on the plane. But without knowing exactly what the explosive materials were, it's a little hard to tell whether or not the existing swabbing and air sampling methods would have caught them.
Well, and we're hearing from a bomb expert that we just spoke to that some of the chemicals could be nitroglycerin, methyl nitrate, nitromethane, and, you know, as you said, we wouldn't know. But we do know that in March, a Government Accountability Office released a report about a test of 21 airports where bomb-making materials of various kinds were smuggled through security. Not a single airport caught them. So obviously, you know, there are concerns.
Absolutely, and this is one reason that airports have started experimenting with these explosive detection chambers, because there is a recognition that the next security incident was unlikely to be like 9/11, unlikely to involve knives and box cutters, and probably likely to involve explosives.
And by the way, remind us, when you talk about what's already in place, remind us a little more about them. We've talked here on the program about, for instance, the puffers that are searching for chemical profiles. What are some of the things in place?
The explosive detection chambers, or the puffers, are little telephone booth-sized machines that passengers walk through. A blast of air is blown through the chamber. That air is then pulled into a sampler, which rapidly analyzes the air sample for traces of chemicals. A warning is flashed if the chemical sample reveals something that is suspicious. That person would go on to secondary screening. They'd have their baggage swabbed. They'd probably have a hand inspection and so forth. There are also swabbing procedures which are used periodically on electronics like computers, but also in the inside of bags, where a little wand with a piece of cloth at the bottom is wiped through the piece of baggage, wiped over the computer. That piece of cloth then goes into a machine, yeah, which works somewhat similar to the puffer chamber, that the swab is analyzed for traces of materials that might be of concern. And then, of course, you have the primary visual inspection method of the X-ray and the magnetometer. But in this case, the only way the X-ray is really going to help you is to identify liquids. It's not going to give you any particular insight as to what the liquid is.
Liquid is. How many airports have this, and how soon before every airport has, for instance, puffers?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I have the exact number. I do know, though, that the airports that are using them, they're not in every terminal. The reason behind the experimentation is to figure out how accurate they are, how long they'll work in the field before they need servicing, and those kinds of things.
And we know they're very expensive. What else are your concerns? Again, lend your expertise to the issue at hand today, the disruption of the alleged plot out of London. Were you and others thinking about this, you know, hand-carried water bottles with explosives in them?
Well, I think we actually got our first really important signal of the potential direction, I believe, in 2004, when two Chechen terrorists carried liquid explosives onto planes out of Moscow and detonated them, brought both those planes down probably within a half an hour of each other. There's some disagreement over the specifics and exactly what they used to bring the planes down, but I think most people lean in the direction of thinking that it was some kind of liquid version of an explosive that was detonated. And by the way, in the case of the Moscow incidents, both of the suspects were female.
And given that, you know, had you been advising that liquid not be carried onto planes, or how do you address that?
The most important route is through improved ability to identify explosives, and that's why I think there's the push, and there will undoubtedly be rapidly renewed emphasis on expanding the experimentation and the use of the explosive detection chambers.
One of our colleagues who's traveled extensively said that, I believe it was in China, she and all the travelers with her were asked to drink whatever containers that they had with them before they got on the plane. Is that something, I mean, something that simple, is that something that perhaps should be started here in the U.S.?
It's not necessarily a bad thing to do, but sophisticated terrorist is going to know that might be a potential security measure. There could be a false bottom, you know, on the container of liquid that keeps the explosive separate from, you know, what looks like is being sipped. So it's certainly, it's not a foolhardy security measure, but it's not a complete one either.
Not foolproof either.
Right.
Jack Riley, Homeland Security expert for RAND Corporation. He just testified this week to the House Homeland Security Subcommittee about security at airports and his concerns about them. Jack Riley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come today, we'll take a break from the news for some scary fiction. New dark tales from Mystic River author Dennis Lehane. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we want to take a moment now to talk about news just out today about groundbreaking research in the area of lung cancer, a disease which kills more Americans than any other cancer. Scientists at Duke University have discovered a new genetic test that can determine which lung cancer patients should get chemotherapy and which wouldn't benefit. The findings were published today in the New England Journal of Medicine, and joining us with more is here now is health and science reporter Alan Cockle. Alan, welcome.
Hi.
And remind us, how are treatment decisions made for lung cancer patients now?
Right. So what we're talking about with this particular study is a particular kind of lung cancer called non-small cell lung cancer. It's about 85% of all lung cancers. Everyone has the tumor surgically removed, and people with large tumors with lymph nodes also get chemotherapy. The big question is, if you have quite a small tumor, do you get chemotherapy or not? And that's really where this research comes into bear. Very small tumors right now don't get chemo, but if you're 3 centimeters, no chemo, 3.1 centimeters, you might get chemo. So that's the cutoff, tumor size. It's not very good, but it's the best there is.
Right. And now there is this new genetic test. What is it? How does it work?
This is a way to build on the work of the Human Genome Project. They take a tissue sample from the tumor when it's removed, and they run it through a high-throughput genetic analysis, and they look to see which genes are turned on in that tumor. So it's sort of a snapshot of the biology of the tumor. And what they've done is they've analyzed a lot of cancer patients and found which genetic profiles are associated with good or bad survival. So now instead of looking just at tumor size, the doctors could look at the actual snapshot of the tumor. The research was led by Dr. Anil Poti at Duke University, and he talked about the snapshot of cancer biology this way.
This is no different than a fingerprint. Each individual is separate. It's just that your fingerprint is based from your genes, and it can actually identify, tell you something about the biology of cancer and what the cancer might do in your body.
So that's Dr. Anil Poti, who led the study that Alan Cockle is telling us about. And Alan, how could this new genetic test impact the treatment of newly diagnosed lung cancer patients? How would it work?
In two really important ways, both looking at who would get chemo and who would be spared chemo. Let's hear from Dr. Thomas Lynch, who heads the thoracic cancer team at Massachusetts General Hospital. He wasn't involved in the study, but he sees a lot of lung cancer patients in his practice, and he says the implications are really exciting.
This research will allow us to select which patients should get chemotherapy, including some we're not treating. You know, that woman with a very small tumor might turn out to have a molecular predictive index that tells us we better treat this person. So the first key thing is it will help us treat people we're not treating. The second potential is it might allow us to avoid treating some people who we are treating. Maybe we find out that Mr. Jones doesn't need chemotherapy afterwards.
So that's Dr. Tom Lynch from Massachusetts General Hospital. He points out that lung cancer accounts for more cancer deaths than ovarian, breast, prostate, cancer, lymphoma, all combined. So even an incremental improvement in survival rates would be really significant here. The current way that it's done, the predictive, their ability to predict survival is 55 or 60%. This bumps it up to 80%. So it's significant. It could save thousands of lives a year, and it could save thousands more patients having chemo that they may not need.
I'm wondering, Alan, if there's any sort of downside, though. I mean, the idea that somebody would be able to have yet another genetic test, is there any question about, you know, any problems arising from that?
Well, a very good question. And what a lot of people ask and what I wondered is, can you screen at birth? And no, the important point here is that this is not a screen of your genome, your genes in every cell in your body from birth. This is a look at which genes are turned on in the tumor. So it doesn't tell you who's going to get cancer, but once someone gets cancer, it tells you something about the biology of that growing tumor.
All right. Quick question. Does this kind of genetic testing exist for other cancers, or is it, you know, maybe down the road?
It's certainly down the road. It's in testing now for breast cancer. There's some lymphoma stuff around the horizon, but this same approach that the group at Duke University has taken with lung cancer is potentially applicable to many, many cancers. So this kind of personalized medicine, if this plays out, and this will be tested in a large clinical trial that will begin in January, if it's as successful as early signs make it look, then, you know, this will be something down the road that we'll see a lot of.
Here Now Science reporter Alan Cockle. Alan, thanks as always.
Pleasure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A quick recap of our top story on the alleged plot to blow up U.S.-bound passenger jets from Britain. 21 suspects are under arrest in the U.K. Officials at Heathrow Airport hope to resume normal operations tomorrow, but they say passengers would still face delays and a ban on carry-on luggage for the foreseeable future. In the U.S., huge lines are forming at airport security checkpoints, and passengers are forbidden from bringing liquids onto planes. They can still bring on carry-on luggage here in the U.S. Well, to fiction, please, and to author Dennis Lehane, who has a way with small-time characters. His novel Mystic River made a tiny Irish-American neighborhood the setting for an epic conflict, which was later made into the Oscar-winning film. His book Gone, Baby, Gone sets up a tight triangle of friends involved in a kidnapping. Ben Affleck just finished directing a film version of that novel here in Boston. And now Coronado, a collection of short stories and even a play. Hollywood is again interested. The book is populated by just-sprung convicts, inept prostitutes, and cheating couples. They live in small-town wastelands, in trailer parks, pickup trucks, usually with a gun close by. In the story, Running Out of Dog, one man goes off to Vietnam and returns wounded. His childhood friend Blue stayed home. But as Elgin recalls that childhood together, he reminds us Blue was wounded in a different kind of battlefield.
Blue is a reader. Knew more about science and ecology, about anatomy and blue whales and conversion tables, than anyone Elgin knew. Most everyone figured the kid for a mute. Hell, he'd been held back twice in the fourth grade. But with Elgin, he'd sometimes chat up a storm while they puffed smokes together down at the drainage ditch behind the park. He'd talk about whales, how they bore only one child, who they were fiercely protective of, but how if another child was orphaned, a mother whale would take it as her own, protect it as fiercely as she did the one she gave birth to. He told Elgin that sharks never slept, how electrical currents worked, what a depth charge was. Elgin, never much of a talker, just sat and listened, ate it up, and waited for more.
That's author Dennis Lehane reading from Running Out of Dog, one of the stories in Coronado, and he's here to tell us more. Dennis, welcome back.
Thanks.
And, you know, I picked that passage because, well, it just seems to telegraph something that I love about your characters. In your characters, you know, let's say the adults in Mystic River, for instance, you seem to see something wounded in them. And in this short story, we find out what it is, you know, that Blue's mother was a prostitute. And, you know, here he is talking about whales who love their kids when she obviously didn't. And,
Yeah. You
know, then we meet him later as adult. Are you thinking of your adult characters' childhoods when you write about them?
No, I think it just sort of... I think we're all products of our childhood, without a doubt. And the moments of extremists, we sort of revert back to what we were as children. That's why, you know, a lot of emotion doesn't come out direct the way you see it on TV. I think a lot of human emotion comes out sideways. Mm. And you don't even know what you're reacting to. And so I think there's something in the stories and in the novels that is speaking about that idea. What Graham Greene said... We should be thankful we cannot see the horrors of our childhood lying around in cupboards everywhere. And there's a line I always love, from Power and the Glory. Mm. So, I think that's... And I don't think you need to... You can have the nicest childhood in the world, and you're still going to be filled with a lot of confusion and a lot of loneliness and a lot of rage that came from being a child.
Sure, we rush to say that. But these characters... for the large part, did not have nice childhoods.
No, there's definitely a lot of dysfunction in the world of these stories, certainly.
And these are stories that are set in small southern towns, except for one sort of Kafkaesque story set in a complex of hospitals. Where did you get that feeling for southern characters?
I lived down south for 8 years. I went to college down there, then I worked down there, then I went to graduate school down there. And I definitely picked up an affinity for it. And I think every writer's born with at least one gift. Some are born with five, but the gift I always had was I always had an ear. It's mm-hmm. called an ear. I very quickly pick up the cadence of a language.
Mm-hmm. Is there a danger in that of a southern reader saying, wait a minute, you're from Boston, that's not the South?
Probably if I wrote a novel set in the South, I think that's when people would come out with their knives, and maybe deservedly so, because I'm not sure I could set a novel entirely down the South, mm-hmm. because I'm still a tourist there, and that works for stories. You can be a tourist for 20 pages or 40 pages in the case of Running Out of Dog. But But then after a certain point, I need to go back into a culture in which, is, you know, the best way I can put it is I know what's in everybody's kitchen.
Some of the characters, the rebel suburban schoolgirl who trashes a house, somebody who grew up in a trailer with a gun, you know, they can be caricatured. And there's sort of a fish in the barrel kind of, you know, aspect to it. How do you, you know, avoid that? Because you do avoid that.
Well, I think that's what you do. You say, okay, I'm starting off with certainly, I wouldn't say a caricature, but an archetype. And how do I make this person come alive? How do I not have, you know, the white trash redneck with the I voted for Bush bumper sticker and the, you know, everything you expect to see, because I love the South. I don't want to be this East Coast elitist who caricatures.
There's a lot of violence in these pieces, teenage revenge, murderous road trips, sort of stupid violence. I'm thinking of Until Gwen, which you later adapted into the play Coronado.
Yep.
What were you – and this is the story of the convict who gets out. His dad picks him up.
His dad picks him up, and the question becomes, what is the father's motive? What are they looking for? Mm. What happened to a woman named Gwen? It's just it went its own way. That first sentence was a sentence I'd had in my back pocket for about 10 years.
Read that sentence.
Your father picks you up from prison in a stolen Dodge Neon with an 8-ball in the glove compartment and a hooker named Mandy in the back seat. So the story starts off with a kind of comic vibe, and I thought it was going to end up just being this wacky story about this crazy father who picks up his son and they go off looking for something.
Yeah.
And then gradually, as the story went on, and it was written in the middle of a thunderstorm, it just got darker and darker and darker and became a story about is love possible in that world?
That world of bottom feeding.
Yeah. I mean, the father is the closest thing I've ever come to a pure out-and-out villain.
So what are you saying? Because we started by saying how what I've loved about the Lehane characters is that you can see this sort of wounded child somewhere in them. No wounded child here?
You can see it in the play. You can definitely see it in the play. He was destroyed by a love not working out. And that's what created the monster. And I think I just think there's a lot of people, World War II Germany shows us. There's a lot of people out there who don't know either how good or how bad they are, and will never find out because they'll never be tested. And Bobby's father, at least in the play, Coronado, is the guy who got tested, and he discovered how bad he is. Hmm. And after a certain point, he just embraced it. With the stories in here, there is certainly in a couple of the middle ones, I think there's an awful lot of hope.
But hope, even though, without giving away too many things, people bash other people over the heads with shovels and shoot dogs and practically decapitate girls and hang them. The hope is
that little pinpoint of light can shine out through the darkness. I mean, people who say to me sometimes, they'll say, you know, your work is so dark. And I'm like, have you been paying attention? Do you look around? Have you heard of Darfur? Have you looked at some of the amputated soldiers coming back from Iraq? Where do you grow up? Where do you live? I'm not saying that it should be all darkness. I hate pessimism. I'm far too Catholic for pessimism. but I do think that the greatest light is the smallest bit that can shine through the darkness.
Dennis Lehane's new book of stories is called Coronado. Coronado is the play adaptation of Until Gwen, and now going to be seen on the big screen. Dennis Lehane, thanks as always for coming by to keep us up to date.
Oh, thank you, Robin. Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.